Hello and welcome to the European Respiratory Society podcast, featured on the newly launched ERS Respiratory Channel. My name is Paul O'Byrne, and I am the Dean and Vice President of the Faculty of Health Sciences at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario, in Canada. My research interests focus on the mechanisms and treatment of asthma, and I'm therefore very happy to be involved in this discussion today, which will focus on developments in asthma. Joining me in this discussion is Professor Ian Pavord. I've known Ian for a long time now. He is a professor of respiratory medicine at the University of Oxford and honorary consultant physician at the Oxford University Hospitals. He is also a fellow of the European Respiratory Society. Ian has a research interest in the clinical aspects of inflammatory airway diseases and has pioneered the use of non-invasive measures of airway inflammation in the assessment of these conditions. He has identified a number of clinically important phenotypes of inflammatory airway disease, as well as discovering clinically important biomarkers. Ian has played a lead role in the clinical development of three of the most promising new treatments for severe airway disease. So all in all, Ian is extremely well qualified to talk about this topic. Our discussion was recorded in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic, so unfortunately, we were not able to meet face to face. Ian, you and I have known each other for, several decades and have seen a lot of change in the way that asthma has been managed over that time. I was wondering if we could begin today by asking you to look backward just a little bit and think about, maybe comment on the way that asthma has been managed when you were beginning your career as a respiratory physician and starting your training as a clinical scientist.
Yeah, well, I actually did my PhD in an asthma-related topic, and I have to say, I found it very difficult to manage patients with asthma because there was a disconnect between what I was seeing in the clinic and what I was reading. And the one guy whose papers made most sense to me was Freddie Hargreave. And I got a sense reading his papers that he saw patients and that he really thought about patients. And I had an opportunity to go and work with Freddie, which I jumped at. And that was at a time in the mid-90s where I think we'd got stuck. I don't know what you think, but I suspect we'd got stuck with our disease concepts. We knew that type 2 airway inflammation was an important process, but we hadn't really worked out how it contributed to patient morbidity. We were making a lot of extrapolations without really having nailed the evidence. And Freddie, you know Freddie as well as I do. He was very pernickety about things like that. Yeah, he used to say, if you can't measure something, then you really can't talk about it. And at the time I went out to work with Freddie, he was becoming very interested in measuring airway inflammation, which I think has been the advance that has really triggered an enormous period of progress in our area. I don't know if you agree with that, but for me, that's been the catalyst for everything that followed.
I do agree with that very much, Ian, and I fully agree with your characterization of Freddie. He was a wonderful clinical scientist, and I think partly because he was such a good clinician. And the questions came always from the patient.
Yeah, absolutely. So
could I ask you to expand a little bit on the issue of measuring inflammation, what we did know way back and then what changed and how that has sort of led us forward in an important way?
Well, there have been important studies, and I think you did as much as anyone else, that had identified eosinophilic airway inflammation using bronchoscopic techniques and had developed lovely models of type 2 airway inflammation using allergen challenge. And we were learning a lot about the mediators that underpinned type 2 airway inflammation, the cytokines and other things. But the big acid test was the first biologic targeting a type 2 cytokine, and that was mepolizumab, which was trialed in a study that I think you criticized, rightfully criticized, an allergen challenge study, and subsequently in a clinical trial, and showed absolutely no efficacy. So despite having enormous biological effects, it reduced eosinophilic airway inflammation, but there was no clinical benefit. There was no effect on the airway response to allergen. There was no effect on histamine responsiveness, lung function or symptoms. So that happened in the late 90s. That was a surprise for many of us. I don't think Freddie was that surprised, and I'm not sure you were surprised, or I was particularly surprised, but many people were.
It was indeed a fascinating time, because much of the preclinical science, and indeed even the early clinical science, supported a role for eosinophils in various components of asthma. But as you say, the early clinical trials didn't support that. So what happened after that, Ian, and what made you decide to pursue that, even though the initial signals weren't very promising with the biologics?
When I was working in Hamilton, I did clinics with Freddie, and I enjoyed it immensely. We used to have donuts at 11 in the morning. I remember that. That's a great way of breaking up. And we would always talk about patients, and yeah, everything had to be explained for Freddie. And he was assessing patients with airways disease very carefully. So every patient would have airway responsiveness measured and would have induced sputum done before we saw them in clinic. So we were seeing things that no one else was seeing at that time. And it became clear really very early on that eosinophilic airway inflammation and the abnormality of airway function that underpinned many of the symptoms were, to some extent, disconnected. You could have more of one or more of the other. And, you know, between patients, you saw different patterns of disease. So you saw patients that had very inflammation-predominant disease and other patients that had very airway dysfunction-predominant disease. You know, the question arose, well, look, I mean, if you gave meeplizumab to the people that have inflammation-predominant disease and you looked at an outcome measure that is relevant to that inflammation, and I think symptoms are not that relevant, but asthma attacks are very relevant, then might you get a different story? And we both thought this because we were talking a lot in those days, and there were many other people that felt that we'd missed potentially clinically important efficacy by doing a clinical trial in the wrong population, looking at the wrong outcome measure. So, yeah, we were both able to persuade, and it took some persuading, didn't it, GSK to have another look at meeplizumab. And you did a lovely study in oral steroid-dependent asthma, which is a very type 2 high pattern of disease usually. And we did a study in people with severe asthma that were having recurrent exacerbations and had good evidence of eosinophilic airway inflammation. And the rest is history. I mean, we both showed clear evidence of efficacy. And what I found really personally satisfying, and I expect you did as well, was when the phase 3 studies were published in the New England Journal, they exactly replicated the studies that we'd done, except they multiplied the numbers by 10. And the findings, to almost within the same decimal point, were exactly the same as our studies. And that was great. I mean, it was a wonderful chapter in my career, and I'm sure it was for you to see this, you know, prediction that we'd made translate actually into real patient benefit. You know, and we haven't stopped making progress since then. I think it's been enormously important to make this move, I think, from where we were in the mid-90s to where we were, you know, 10 years ago. And everything we touch now seems to turn to gold, don't you think?
Yes, absolutely. Ian, I'd like you to reflect for a minute and perhaps comment on the role of clinical pharmacology, but the biologics, these precision tools, not only in helping our patients, which of course you've talked about very thoroughly, but also helping us understand the science behind the disease.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we are creating knockout humans. So we're creating IL-5 knockout humans and seeing what happens. And the one thing that I think we're increasingly confident about is you can take these cytokines out and type 2 airway inflammation without exposing the patient to much by way of risk of side effects. We've been increasingly confident, many thousands of patients are treated now, that there are no major treatment-associated side effects. But it's been very interesting to create these knockouts. I mean, blocking TSLP, you've done a lovely study, but that must have been the biggest impact you've ever seen a therapeutic have on allergen challenge when you create TSLP knockout humans. So you can start manipulating the patient's immune response, and then applying these well-validated and very well-understood preclinical models like allergen challenge and see what happens. And I think the allergen challenge study you did with tezepelumab was incredibly important and very predictive of what would happen in the clinic with that drug, actually.
I can't help but say, Ian, that there have been a couple of instances in my career where you had moments that you just never forget. The instant when you actually look at data for the first time and you think, my goodness, this is a game changer. That was certainly true with mepolizumab, and you're absolutely right with the what's now tezepelumab.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, I remember seeing the data for the first time, and I remember seeing the DREAM data, which in many ways was very exciting because it was a beautiful replication of what had been found. But, you know, I remember my attitude being, well, of course, we knew this would happen. We knew this, but we didn't really. I mean, I was being blasé. Yes. Of course, well, what are we going to do next?
Yes.
But looking back, it was very important. And of course, the way that drug was developed and all of the biologics have been developed by the pharma industry has been exemplary. And Steve Yancey at GSK has done an amazing job in steering mepolizumab out into the clinic. Many patients are benefiting. And similarly with Ariel Temper and Mark Gione with dupilumab, you know, they made all the right decisions. And, you know, and the drugs have got out there into the clinic and they're helping patients. And working with industry, and we both do this, has been very interesting, but they've done a great job. Do you agree with that?
Without doubt. I think that's exactly true. I mean, you think about it, Ian, it's now slightly over 20 years since we originally started to talk about the opportunities these drugs provided. And we now have potentially five different biologics with four different mechanisms of action or working in slightly different ways in the T2 space, and all of them showing tremendous benefit. So maybe I could ask you about that. Do you think we have fully covered the T2 space with the biologics we have? Do we need anything else? And then what else are we still missing in relation to severe asthma? What would you most like to see as an advance in that area?
It's a crowded space, but there are a lot of patients out there, and we're probably only treating a fraction of the patients with type 2 high asthma. And what we're doing, it's a bit like the rheumatologists in the early days of anti-TNF in rheumatoid arthritis, is we're waiting for patients to be really in a bad way before, and we're trying to rescue the situation. And increasingly, as confidence in these drugs grows, I think we'll be identifying patients with hot disease based on biomarkers and saying, well, look, we could intervene now and prevent a very uncertain future, or we could wait for you to have really serious problems and then try and rescue the situation. So I suspect that we will be intervening at an earlier and earlier stage with these drugs. So there's plenty of room for different drugs. There's also the possibility that there are different phenotypes of type 2 high asthma. So we may start talking about systemically driven type 2 asthma, where the blood eosinophil signal is very dominant and anti-IL-5 works incredibly well in that group of patients. We know that. Or you may say, well, this patient's got a much more airway-centric problem with very high pheno, very high, we like to call it magnet in the airway, pulling eosinophils in. So it's not a reservoir problem, it's a magnet problem. And maybe that patient needs dupilumab or tezepelumab more. This is all speculation. You know, we don't have the data to support this, but that might be where we go. We have a lot of patients that have a lot of morbidity without having any type 2 airway inflammation at all. Bronchodilators can be helpful, and long-acting bronchodilators have been an important advance. But what else is driving morbidity? We think persistent airway infection is an important process, and probably it's that treatable trait that macrolides are targeting. I think Peter Gibson's data is pretty persuasive and impressive. But sometimes in medicine, you know, knowing what you can do and knowing what you can't do are just as important. And we're getting closer to recognizing what we can't do. You know, what are the unmet needs? And if we can present those to the pharma industry and say, look, this is a problem for us, and these seem to be the mechanisms that are driving this problem, then we can get drugs and stop doing clinical trials where the effect is diluted to the point where we miss it.
Just to follow up on that point, because I think it's one of the really important lessons learned in this whole development of the biologics, and that is doing what I think of as precision clinical trials. So really identifying the phenotype of patient very, very carefully. Ideally, if you had an endotype, if we could do that really well, that might even be a little bit better. And then applying your new therapy in that area. And I think that was one of the huge mistakes made early on by industry, that they sort of put it into everybody and hoped to see a signal where it just didn't happen. But they picked up on that very quickly. And now, of course, we are really trying hard to make it more and more precise around the selection of patients. I wonder if you could just comment on that. Is it feasible now to identify the populations, do you think, that don't necessarily have the T2 high asthma in order to do the clinical trials that we need to do?
Yeah, I completely agree with the point you just made. And it seems so obvious looking back that there would, you know, we're not going to find treatments for asthma. We're going to find treatments for an asthma. And, you know, what we have to do as clinical investigators is identify the asthma where that mechanism is playing an important part. Try and find ways of measuring that process so they're clinically accessible, and then we might make progress. But the non-type 2 high space is very messy. There's a lot of comorbidity. For example, most cluster analysis in asthma and severe asthma have pulled out an obese female phenotype, which is type 2 low, very high symptom expression. You know, could that have anything to do with systemic inflammation, IL-6? You know, these are all interesting questions. But you did some lovely work with CXCR2 antagonists. And that's an interesting tool, a low molecular weight drug that does reduce neutrophilic airway inflammation. There seem to be pretty clear data from you and Param showing that sputum neutrophil counts were falling by a clinically important amount. But they didn't do anything in a sort of unselected asthma population. In COPD, again, not a lot of evidence of efficacy in an unselected group. But when they looked at smokers, they seemed to respond to CXCR2 antagonists, whereas ex-smokers or non-smokers didn't. And I thought that was interesting because with macrolides, we see the exact opposite. So current smokers don't respond to macrolide, whereas ex-smokers do. And that made me wonder whether there may be two types of neutrophilic airway inflammation. So you've got a type that's driven by an exogenous factor such as cigarette smoke, where inhibiting it with a CXCR2 antagonist would be a sensible thing to do. And another where the inflammation is in response to an infection, where it's not sensible to inhibit it and it's more sensible to treat the cause. But this is all for the future. But at least we've got a clearer perspective on this unmet need. I think that's important.
You've made a huge number of important contributions, Ian, during your career. It's been a very, very impressive career and one I've admired immensely. And one of the concepts that you brought out, you and your colleagues in Leicester, when you were, where you were there at the time, that I think was a complete game changer. And again, looking back, you think, such an obvious thing. But at the time, it really wasn't. And that is that the distinction between patients who have a ton of inflammation and very few symptoms, and those who have a lot of symptoms and very little inflammation. That very famous Halder paper that I'm sure has been cited, goodness knows, thousands of times likely. And it again has, I think, set the stage for all of this thinking that you've subsequently, I think, led the world in relation to identifying subsets, if you like, of people that you can target in one way versus another way. So that's been an incredible contribution.
What we had in Leicester, though, was very much what you had in McMaster. So the other thing you did a lot that I loved when I came there, and I was very lucky. I was very fond of Jerry Dolovich. He was very ill when I went, but he had an incredible mind. And it was clear looking at Freddie and Jerry that they had a very special connection. That you had in Jerry somebody that was having ideas all the time. You know, and a lot of them were harebrained. And Freddie had this ability to see. He was a logistician, wasn't he? He had the ability to see that. Hold on a minute. What did you just say?
Yeah.
Yeah, that has potential. And this freedom of talking, and no one was afraid of, you know, you would be told that you'd said something ludicrous, but in a good-humoured way. And in Britain, we don't tend to do that. There's a certain amount more deference sometimes. But what we tried to, I think, to, you know, I was very lucky with my colleagues in Leicester and with the fellows, you know, had Andy Wardlaw and Mike Morgan and Chris Breitling and Ruth Green and, you know, Pranav Halder. You've talked to them. They were amazing people, Surinder Bearing. But we did try and create that. Don't be afraid to ask big questions, you know, and speculate. And let's run with a story and let's see how far it takes us. You know, the sort of thing that Jerry used to do with Ferdy. So I suspect that was an import. Again, another example of the huge influence that that time I spent in Canada had. But it was a very exciting time as well. And my colleagues were enormously generous. So there was a real sense of, you know, let's do this together. And, you know, we didn't have petty rivalries and other things. I didn't see any of that in McMaster either. You know, there was a sense that let's just get on with it. And isn't this exciting? Which, of course, it is. It is exciting.
Absolutely right. Ian, we focused quite a bit of our discussion so far on severe asthma. And I wanted to perhaps to have you think about and comment for a moment or two on the more mild patients, because there's been quite a, I think, an important change in thinking in relation to how milder patients are managed. And even the concept that mild patients are at risk of severe events, severe attacks, is something that I think is relatively new. It was assumed that if you had mild asthma, it really was truly mild and you weren't at any risk, which of course is just not the case. So maybe I could ask your thoughts on what's been happening in that area the past few years.
Yeah, I said earlier that as a junior doctor, I just didn't get asthma. I didn't understand it, even though I'd done a PhD in the topic. And yeah, by way of example, I remember as a relatively new registrar being called to A&E to see a dead 14-year-old who had died of asthma. It was too late by the time we arrived. And the mother, you know, having to tell the mother that this child had died, and her saying, well, he's never had bad asthma. He only uses occasional puffs of Ventolin. The nurse did his peak flow 2 months ago and said it was normal. And that's the paradox here, that mild doesn't mean low-risk asthma. And in Melbourne, you'll remember in November 2016, they had a meteorological event that led to every ITU bed in the whole city being full of people with mild asthma, you know, mild asthma that nearly killed them. So there is this paradox here between symptom expression and risk, which we haven't got a good handle on. The other issue is our approach to mild asthma has been to treat airflow limitation. But many patients with mild asthma, including that 14-year-old and the people in Melbourne, probably have sudden, very severe type 2 airway inflammation that's incredibly high risk. And your treatment is not addressing that. So mild asthma, I think the outlook in mild asthma will be transformed by anti-inflammatory reliever therapy, which is using a rapid onset beta agonist, usually formoterol, in combination with a steroid. And it doesn't matter really what steroid, for relief of symptoms. And you've been very involved in the two New England studies that showed that this approach was as good as regular inhaled steroids at controlling exacerbations. I was involved in a more real-world study, the Novel START study, which Richard Beasley ran, which showed, in fact, as needed, anti-inflammatory reliever outperformed regular inhaled steroids in terms of asthma exacerbations. And it's what patients do. Patients with mild asthma don't want to take treatment every day when they have problems maybe 1 week a year. So changing our reliever strategy, I think, is an absolute no-brainer. I think it just has to happen. And I thought Gina was incredibly correct and bold, but absolutely right to make this step. I don't know what you feel. The absolutely brave step that we've got to get this through. We've got to push it through. We've probably got a little bit of work to do on that, but we do need to push it through.
I could not agree with you more, Ian, in that regard. So, Ian, we've just spent the past few minutes talking about the past 20 years of asthma and its treatment and the advances that have been made. So I'm going to ask you perhaps as a final question to look ahead 10 years or so and see what would change if you could make it happen in that highly unlikely event that everything were to go exactly as you would like it to, what would be different 10 years from now?
Well, that's a really interesting question, and maybe we can both have a go at this. But I think, well, let's look at it from the perspective of somebody with asthma. I think if that 14-year-old went to their GP in 2025, the GP would say, well, yeah, your lung function's good. You don't have a symptom problem, but your biomarkers are red hot. You know, you've got the equivalent of malignant hypertension and a cholesterol of 10, and that's not good. So that brown inhaler that's gathering dust in your bathroom cabinet, that could save your life. Maybe that would be a better consultation for that 14-year-old who had obviously said, no, I don't need a regular treatment. I'm 14, you know, I play rugby. Come on. I have symptoms once in a while. And if the inhaler that they had in the bathroom cabinet had a steroid in it, they wouldn't have died. I'm quite sure of that. I'm absolutely sure. So I'd like to see that happen. And then if that patient went back and said, look, I'm getting more symptoms, and the GP thinks, well, I wonder if this person needs to be on regular treatment. The treatment would be chosen based on an assessment of what was driving the person's problems rather than a one-size-fits-all sort of treatment escalator. So you would say, well, look, we're going to have to take a closer look. Your lung function looks all right, but you've got high biomarkers. So I'm going to suggest you go on a regular biologic. And if that continues to be a problem, despite demonstrated adherence with a steroid, you know, maybe we'll get a biologic into the picture earlier before, you know, you have a life-threatening attack or before your life is irreparably changed by you having asthma. But if you've got more of a symptom and a lung function problem, maybe we'd target bronchodilators more. So using anti-inflammatory reliever as your reliever strategy to some extent takes care of treatment adherence issues. It takes care of risk. And it does turn the focus on who should have regular treatment and what should that regular treatment look like. And it allows you to start using regular treatment in a personalized way. So you could, if somebody's on anti-inflammatory reliever therapy, you could, and there's no type 2 biology to measure at all, you could say, well, you know, you've got an FEV1 of 40% predicted, so you need bronchodilators, but I'm not going to, in fact, give you any more steroid because that aspect of the problem is not showing its head. And your reliever strategy will cover the possibility of you having intermittent type 2 high inflammation. So, yeah, that 14-year-old would be treated in a very different way, and he wouldn't have ended up dead in casualty in Peterborough District Hospital. If we can pull off anti-inflammatory reliever and we can talk about biomarker-directed regular treatment, I would be disappointed if we didn't achieve the sort of reductions in mortality that the cardiologists have achieved with ischemic heart disease in the last 10 years, you know, 70% reductions. You did it in the 90s when the first guidelines were produced and we really focused on using inhaled steroid. That 10-year period where we had a great clinician-industry collaboration was associated with probably a halving of asthma death rates in many countries, you know, and hospitalization rates. But we've gone as far as we can with that. And the next frontier is about better reliever strategies and being personalized about who has regular treatment and using biomarkers. So that's my view. What about you? What do you think in 10 years' time?
Well, I wish I could have said what I think as well as you have said it, Ian, because I fully and absolutely agree with your thinking. I do think as well that our colleagues in industry are very smart and very agile, and we're going to have, I suspect, approaches to target eosinophils or other specific cell types that perhaps are easier to use and perhaps a bit cheaper. One of the limiting factors of the biologics, of course, are the costs involved in using them. So now that we know, we have very clear idea or a clearer idea of exactly how important these cells are or these mediators are, there will be very clever approaches developed that will help us target these particular cells or mediators, perhaps in a different but an easier and cheaper way. And then you are, of course, exactly right, identifying very carefully who the right person is to give these drugs to is the secret. Ian, you have been brilliant. Thank you very much for this.
It's always a great pleasure, Paul. You know, I haven't told people, but when I came out to McMaster, one of the reasons was I wanted to get to know you as well, because I greatly admired your paper. But you went to Sweden for that year.
It was a mistake I have regretted ever since, Ian.
Hope to see you in person soon. I hope it's not too much longer. But
I want to come visit you in Oxford. I've never been to Oxford. And so,
yeah, I think you'd like it, as long as you behave yourself.
Thanks so much, Ian. Take care.
Yeah, cheers. Thanks, Paul, and all the best to you. Yeah, lovely to talk.
Thank you for joining us for this ERS podcast, and many thanks to Professor Ian Payvard for his contribution and insights on the topic. Just a reminder that two new podcasts will be released on the ERS Respiratory Channel each month, featuring discussions from experts on the latest hot topics in respiratory medicine.